You know, it occurred to me when I was looking at my files that about 6 years ago I presented something called Fondaise at the RICMA seminar. And this is when I first had these ideas of simplification. And the reason that came about was I was at Drew at the time, and we had a unit for cultural adaptation. And part of what it entails, what that entails, was looking at how difficult things would read and modifying them. And I had a lot of experiences with that, where people literally were reluctant to simplify some of their documents. Why? Consent forms. Why wouldn't they want them simplified? They had to resubmit to IRB. So it's so much easier just to go with the program and get your approval and move along to research. But I stayed with it, and one day I was sitting down. My interest was in health communication. And even though we were simplifying documents of all sorts, just health information, consent forms, there was something missing. There was no method to it. We were doing it kind of on the fly, making it, yes, it was easier. But despite the fact that there's this huge literature, do you remember in the 90s when just about every issue of every journal had something on readability? The readability of this, and the readability of that, and and just accumulating body of literature on that things were difficult to read for the average person in general, and especially people from vulnerable populations. So I sat down in my bedroom, and I wondered, what is it that I'm missing? So I said to myself, I should begin at the beginning. So I picked up Merriam-Webster's 9th edition dictionary and opened it and started reading from the beginning. And then I read what I was looking for. And that's where farm-based foods came from. Kids or not, that's a true story. So what is it? Well, let's start. Clearly, this is a grammar-based method for the simplification of prose. Prose is text. Prose is written material. And to do this, it's very straightforward, but there's some background that we need to discuss first. So, in 1983, a very important report was published, the report of the Task Force on Black and Minority Health, also called the Heckler Report. Correct me if I'm wrong, Keith, but this was the first time they really, in a comprehensive way, looked at minority health. And notice that it was called Black and Minority Health.
Right.
It was because at the time, applications and information was written as white, black, and other. They still hadn't gotten beyond that issue of that Latinos that would represent, for example, a huge portion of the population. So we were other. Nevertheless, Margaret Heckler, who was then Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Reagan administration, was a very conservative administration, put this task force together, and this report was sentinel. And one of the main conclusions that they drew was that there was a need to develop new health information and educational materials that was suitable for specific minority groups where none already exist. The second was that we needed tests or improve new materials before general distribution to determine if those materials are both culturally acceptable and useful. They have utility for the target audience. Do you see that happening? Anyone? I mean, in general, do you see that happening today? We don't.
Pretty much.
And I submit to you that this is a third of a century later. A third of a century later. And yet we haven't had the benefit of new tools to help us do what this task force suggested we do.
So the first one, it didn't mean specifically that the information was just for the minority groups? Did it mean everybody got it, or did it mean we actually tailored the information so it differs?
Yeah, this is their wording on their report.
Yeah.
And this is not, I didn't paraphrase this line. And I also zoomed in on that. But it says much, because you know, we look at things from natural science, from medical science point of view, different cultures perceive health differently, align themselves to care differently, and the social organization of that care differently, whether it be biomedical or traditional. So yeah, we have to bear in mind that one size is not fit all in everything in healthcare, particularly communication. So that's a very important point. Thank you for that. So I went backward. What is the problem in healthcare communication? That there's this divide. Here we are writing things for people, but are we writing in their language? No. We're writing it in a way that we would speak, and you and I would get together and speak, and then we present it to people in the field, in the community, and they're not really understanding. We know this to be true. There's enough literature to show we still have a problem. So it's really, we're talking down on the healthcare consumer in a sense. There's the issue of cognitive design of the material itself, and the cognitive access cost. The more difficult something is to engage, the more you have to really put energy into engaging it. And for people, say, who are ill, chronic diseases, put it this way, we've all had the flu. When you were the worst day of your flu, and I gave you this, say, survey or this document to read that was complicated, would you read it? You have to throw in the garbage, put the rest of the junk mail. And I think it's really like that for people who bear a burden of multiple chronic diseases, which vulnerable populations do. And so aging populations particularly, who experience cognitive decline from aging and are at risk for chronic disease. So here's this burden, and then some of these difficult surveys, this difficult health information. So as you might already know, one of my efforts is using animation as opposed to prose, because 10% of Latinos, migrant Latinos, have never had any education whatsoever that was wrong. Again. And the problem is that it has been demonstrated that most Americans are basic levels or below in terms of their literacy. So we have to address that. So the problem is not only for minority health. It's a general population concern. And again, I'll say what I've always said. Whatever we do to improve health communication with minority populations, we do it for the greater good. It will help the greater good. And that's really how we should be approaching our studies in health disparities, that is going to be for the greater good. And look at the below basic, 14%, basic, 29%, moderately challenging tasks, only 44%. One of the problems is this asterisk with complex tasks, because there was a significant drop nationally from assessments using the National Adult Literacy Survey, that's the NOW, 1992. 13 years later, the percentage, the proportion of people who can read and then complete complex tasks has diminished. And Latinos across the board dropped about 11%. And that could be related to increased migration, because this one was done in Spanish, the NOWs, and the LLS. The first NOW was not done in Spanish. So that's probably why we picked up on that. So we still have a problem there. What has to happen? Well, there's really three things that balance out in terms of health communication from my perspective. The person and their literacy skills, their educational achievements, social experience, their behaviors, readability. And I want to keep that in mind, because this is going to be a big part of this talk, that's legible, comprehensible, and has utility. And cultural mores, language, and social cultural relevance. But which of these can we change? If we want to improve comprehension, then, well, literacy skills, it's a pipe dream to think that we can take a whole population and improve their literacy skills. It's not going to happen. Maybe in the next generation, if our children stop dropping out of school. Your culture is your culture. That's hardly going to change. You have these cultural mores that you adhere to. So our target then is what we provide to them. And from my perspective, this is what I've been doing, is targeting the issue of our communicating with you at your level of cultural more and your level of literacy skills. And that makes sense to me. Well, let me ask you this. Don't read that. Don't read that. Who's that fast? Okay. What is readability? Come on, let's make this. I don't want to be a talking head. Let's interact in this. What is readability? Come on, guys.
Being able to pronounce words or syllables that make up a sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else? Hold on. Jump ahead after. What do we hear about it in publishing and in the journals when we hear readability? What are they doing? What are they estimating? Grade level difficulties. But that is not the true definition of readability. And it's unfortunate that over the decades, the term readability has been honed down just to that. Estimates of reading difficulty using reading formulas. Because way back, one of the definitions of readability is the degree to which a given class of people finds certain reading matter compelling and comprehensible. And this is McLaughlin, who created the SMART formula. Even further back, Dale and Chow, who were pioneers in readability, also felt and also defined readability from the point of view that has a qualitative component as well as a quantitative component. That whole view of readability as just being a number by plugging in a readability formula on the computer must change. And that's part of what Foundbase is about.
Before you go on, so if you have your little circle and then commonality, but you said comprehension.
I'm sorry, then go back to that.
Right? You have comprehension in your box, you have three. That's compelling, is that the same thing we're saying?
Yeah, highlighted compelling, because what is compelling? Isn't it a latent trait? If I find something compelling, you can't measure that directly.
That's a subjective.
My sense of compelling, I feel compelled. I mean, how do I measure that?
How do you measure whether they read the second paragraph?
Can. But what I'm saying is that that's more qualitative, isn't it, than quantitative?
Yeah.
Very compelling. I'll let you go with, give a survey response, very compelling, somewhat compelling. But that's not what I'm speaking about. I don't think that's what McLaughlin meant, because I read into this paper that he wrote. And the fact that, well, let's move on to the next definition, and you'll see what I mean. Readability redefined. And this definition is based on Dale and Charles and McLaughlin and other people who were the experts in Rudolf Flesch. And readability is the sum total of all interactions between all factors that affect the level of success a given category of people have with any segment of grade to mature. How is that success? A readability grade level estimate? Or that it's appealing to them, whether this is presented as text or image, electronically, or by paper. So this is a 21st century definition of readability. And this means what? That it has a qualitative component to it. I have to make it compelling to you, as well as easy enough for you to read, for it to have utility for you. It's not just about a number. So if you look at readability then, in that perspective, it has qualitative attributes, wording, word choices, use of commonly spoken words, and syntax, which is arrangements of words and use of grammar. I could take a sentence and actually flip it around, and it'll still mean the same thing, but if it's not in, say, an active voice, it may not hit home, it's not conversational. We don't speak the way we speak, you know, technically or in academia. Folks out there don't speak that way. We need to converse with them, like, at their level. Quantitative attributes are the formulas. Estimates of reading difficulty, which are all based essentially on number of syllables per word, words per sentence, and some formulas actually use number of characters in a paragraph. So this is, for me, is very important, and it was a revelation to me. And the more I read and looked into it, because I was always concerned with the fact that people will just do a readability estimate with a formula and not think about how they're writing, what words they're using. So the qualitative attributes then, you got to keep them simple and solvent. You got to kiss them. Just remember that. Keep it simple. Monobisyllabic words are impossible. Sometimes you can. Sometimes there are words you cannot find a substitute for. use words commonly spoken to what a target population dealing with, and use an active voice. You know, the most common, and I said this before in previous presentations, that the most commonly used words universally are mono and bisyllabic. I mean, I sat down and went through Chinese words, Spanish words, which tend to be polysyllabic, English and French and Italian, and indeed, when a baby's born, if he's saying, hey, Pop, what's going on? Nice to meet you. He's saying, Papa, Pa, Da. So that's, I think that's very important. How about the last words before you leave the planet? It's probably mono and bisyllabic. And you give me a dissertation when you're going, huh?
I think so. It's understood.
Use a thesaurus. That is your best friend in helping you to simplify those. I'm constantly using the thesaurus and the dictionary. I really do. It helps me a lot when I do this, undertake this task. Quantitative attributes, there are over 100, in fact, over 200 readability formulas have been proposed since the early 19th century. I mean, the early 20th century, the 1920s. The initially, readability was about a compilation of the most commonly used words in the English language. And then when new books were written, they would compare and do a comparison of the new texts' use of words that are considered at this level. And then they came up with formulae. And that's how that started. And Flesch Kincaid, for example, and the Flesch Reading Ease developed by Rudolf Flesch at Columbia are two of the most commonly used formulas. Smog is very common. There's many of them. These are very common because they're available on most word processing programs. And they work. And they actually correlate very well with all other, just about every other reading formula. So the Flesch Kincaid was developed for the military, and it provides a reading grade level. What does that mean? Say it comes up ninth grade level. Does it mean you have to have ninth grade education? No. It means that you should be able to read at that level. Because regardless of what your educational attainment is, if you're not a reader, and a lot of kids aren't today because they're busy with their electronic devices, you lose 3 to 5 grade levels of literacy skills over the years. And this is before you develop Crohn's disease. This is before you age. So we have a problem, Houston. The reading ease formula provides a score from 0 to 100. I like it very much. And the score is, the higher the score, the easier the document is to negotiate in terms of comprehension. And this is just a comparison. You've probably seen this before, reading difficulty ratings. And this is somewhat subjective, but it works. It really does. There was a time when I just used one grade. But then I had a very interesting experience with a woman at UC San Marcos who was an expert in readability in children's books and explained to me that you can't do that because, like anything else, reading skills is normally distributed. So in the seventh grade, there would be sixth graders, for example, maybe in the third standard deviation, negative, let me put it this way, seventh graders, right, on the third standard deviation are poor readers. And they're reading maybe at the sixth, fifth grade level. And likewise on the other side, in the positive standard deviation, you have kids in seventh grade reading 10th grade level. So it's really a range to look at. It's not a single number. And one of my issues with these formulas is that they give you like 10.4th grade, 6.2 grade.
I remember that grade.
Yeah. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me, given that whole bell curve consideration. So I round off to the nearest town, to the nearest hall when I report them.
Is that German?
I'm sorry?
The bottom.
It's very easy to read. Yeah.
Kindergarten.
So let's talk about farm. So that's the setting, okay? Readability is not about a number, so farm-based boots is going to kick you if you don't get that. The idea is, keep in mind, really, the take-home is that it has a qualitative and a quantitative attribute. All right, so what is it? It's an acronym. I like acronyms. And when I read that dictionary and I saw what they call connector words or coordinating conjunctives, actually. So these words are coordinating conjunctives, fundas. The most commonly used connector words that pretty much link clauses together to form compound and complex sentences. And I'll get to that in a second. Boots, by often, on, to, or since, are less commonly used as connector words. And occasionally you'll see punctuation used, where basically to extend the sentence, you see semicolons, colons, and even commas. And interestingly, I'm not going to show it to you today because this is part of next Monday's presentation. The use of commas in prose is really prose poetry. Hemingway is a wonderful example of that, and I'm going to use a sample of Hemingway's work to show you that next Monday. So most commonly is fambes, for, or, nor, but, yet, and, yet, and so. Less commonly, boots. And occasionally and usually, it's sort of a poetic license with writers that they use punctuation in that manner.
Yeah.
Here's an example of what I mean by complex and compound sentences. I could say a simple sentence, one clause, one thought. Johnny went home. Yes. Subject, a verb, and an object, which is the key to simplification. You want to simplify it to one thought. It's easier for people to digest that as opposed to giving them a lot of information at one time. Johnny went home, but first he stopped at the market. But is the coordinating conjunctive there. And so now you have a compound sentence, which by definition contains two or more clauses. Johnny went home as he did, and did as he was told, but first he stopped at the market. Now I've added a third clause, now that makes it a complex sentence. And this is what you find in a lot of health-related material, whether it be surveys, whether it be consent forms, especially consent forms, whether it be just health information in general, you find a lot of complex sentences. So now what is the key to simplification? Someone? Find those coordinating conjunctives.
Make them separate.
Yes. Find where the connector words are and separate the clauses out. A clause is, in grammar, a clause is the smallest grammatical unit that can express a complete proposition. Well, what does that mean? Clauses consist of a subject and a predicate, which is usually a verb and an object. Very simply put. So you have Johnny went home. Very simply. The subject, the verb, the object. And if we can get it that simple, we'll communicate better with our patients and our participants in research. Types of clauses, just quickly, an independent clause is a clause that can stand alone. It's a simple sentence. A dependent clause cannot stand alone because it contains only an object and a verb. For example, a fragmented sentence that says, when the president arrives, it's not a complete thought. What happens after that? What happens after he arrives? Because I can't wait for the bus, as if he knew what was going to be left hanging. So those are dependent clauses that need to be attached to an independent clause for it to make sense. Remember, this is a grammar-based nothing. Yes.
Of course, if you do that, you make it simple, it makes it longer.
Pardon?
If you make it simple, it makes it longer. And there are some complex things.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I could take a complex sentence, and we're going to do that very next slide. And it's not longer, there'll be more sentences. In other words, I can take a complex sentence with four clauses and find those coordinating conjunctives or connector punctuation or connector words, splice them, and I'll have four simple sentences. But which is easier to read? Which is easier to digest? It's, together, they have the same number, perhaps, of characters, same number of syllables, but they're easy to digest. They're a simple sentence. One thought. The key is the one thought at a time. Like, you can only take one spoonful of food at a time, or something like that. Some people just really go for it. Like, does that answer your question? It, the lengthwise?
I'll look at your
I think lengthwise is it actually a little shorter, but I see your point, though. I see your point. You're not really...
You also lose the compelling part, right? Because it's monotonous.
Okay, let's look at the definition of a sentence. This is from Webster's, Merriam-Webster's 9th or 10th article. This is actually definition of sentence. If you ask a kid to go into the dictionary and look up the word sentence, this is what they're going to find. Structurally independent grammatical unit of one or more words in speech, often preceded and followed by pauses, and in writing begun with a capital letter and ended with a period or other end punctuation. The reading level is 18.4 on that, or 18, which is postgraduate, graduate school level. And it's very difficult to read for the average person. And these are the kind of things that our patients and that our research participants are dealing with. So what do we do with that? Where are the coordinating conjunctives in that definition? Where are the connected words, any punctuation? They're all over the place. Or, often, and, by, and, or. So what do I do? What happens if I just splice this at the connection points? You remove those connectors and you're left with this. And I haven't done anything other than remove the connectors here. So does this sound like good sentences? It may not at this stage. Structurally independent grammatical unit of one or more words of speech, preceded and followed by pauses. In writing, begun with a capital letter, ended with a period or other, and punctuation. So you go from something that's reading at 18th grade level to something that's reading at 8th grade level, by just identifying coordinating conjunctives, connected words, or other wording, like the Boots wording, which are not considered and called coordinating conjunctives, but are used to connect clauses into compound and complex sentences. And look how quick, now we have to fix up, now comes a qualitative part of writing. How many of you here really love to write? I mean, not have to write, but love to write. I absolutely love to write. I write a lot of prose, I write a lot of poetry, and clearly much of my life dedicated to academia is writing papers and all the other stuff you have to write.
But getting better. I love it.
I have a love for writing. And so that's probably why I'm into this area of research. Now look what happens further. If we just fix it up a little bit and make it sound more like a sentence, it's a unit of grammar of one or more words. It may be preceded by pauses, it may be followed by pauses, starts with a capital letter, ends with a period, or other end punctuation. Fourth grade. And again, let's just look at the difference there. This is just identifying and removing the connectors and splicing. This is now the qualitative aspect of taking what may be a sentence fragment, a clause that's dependent, and turning it into a simple sentence.
But you lose specificity, right?
Sorry, sir.
You lose specificity.
Do I expect?
You lose specificity.
You lose specificity?
Yeah.
So I would happily give up specificity for comprehension, because you don't have any specificity if they can't understand it in the beginning. What specificity? It's the specificity of, let's go back to that, because I think that's a great comment. I think that's a great comment. The whole question of a structurally independent, one of the things, about, we'll get to this briefly, is that there are so many words that are used. We just love to just use words. You know how many people walking around outside there, down South Central? Well, Best Start Brooklyn. Yo, man, did you check out the structurally independent grammatical unit I sent you? By touch? Come on. The reality is, we need to find ways of communicating at the level of people's cultural mores and cultural experience, at the level of their literacy skills. Did you get the message? It's a question.
It depends on what you think is important, right?
Absolutely.
You obviously didn't think it was important that it, the capital letter is really only associated with writing, because you dropped that right after, right? But maybe that's really important in this definition, right? The fact that they're independent might be really important in this definition. So one has to make decisions about what's important and what's not.
Yes.
And you're going to lose some things that are important.
That's right.
What I would say, though, is that, because I've seen the examples, I don't know, you're going to do the survey examples, is that definitely could change the meaning. I don't know that it would get worse or get better, but if you've made a bad call, it might get worse. You know, there's a potential for losing some information, but I don't think it necessarily has to go in that direction. It actually could improve the communication.
I agree with you both. I do.
I think we need to also add into your comments that you started this with trying to do health information to minorities and people with lower levels of education. And if you give something like this, not only to, I must say, not only to people with lower levels of education, I think a lot of people with high levels of education who are not into our field of interest would see that and just came through and totally lose interest because it's a, it's complicated, and I think so. So when we try to simplify, it's basically for people to understand.
Sounds like a study.
Yeah, but it depends what you want them to understand.
Right, I totally agree with that. Yes.
Well, but I mean, he's making a judgment call. That's what my point is. Like, when he dropped there, you have to sort of get consensus and say, well, is he losing something really critical and he could bring it back in? Right. One person will make a judgment. Maybe everyone will agree with it.
Yeah, that's why one of the things we're doing with the CAF survey is with the series of qualitative assessments to see if people really, what do they mean the same thing? For example, we took both some items in CAF that are very difficult to read, 14, 15, grade level, 16. And we modify them using Foundays and another method that I'll be presenting next Monday, stanzaic versification, based on poetry. And we need to know whether they believe it's asking the same thing. But if they can't read that 16th grade level item, how can they make that call?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all, right? Your point is you want to give something that achieves your goal that has readability. Yes. But I think the point is not, look, we can replicate something much simpler.
That's exactly right.
It isn't that at all.
That's exactly right. It's not going to be exactly the same. You're right. In fact, and at some level, I don't want it to be the same because it's not working. We have an 11% response rate to CAP surveys in some healthcare plans, some health plans. So I don't want the original. It's not working. It's no good. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. We have to fix it. And this, I'm just suggesting one way we may fix it. Then you could take it. For example, if you were to do it, apply these simple methods, they may work differently. And that's a point that needs to be made based on what you just said. It will not always come out the same. And you also said something very important that I appreciate. What's important is what people value. It's what they value. So what I value may not be what the person I'm trying to reach values. How do I know what they're going to value? I know this. They're not getting the message. Margaret Hackler reported it a third of a century ago, and the problem still prevails. So we must do something. It may not be perfect, but it's better than what we have, and that's truly my judgment call, that this is better than what we have.
But also at that point, I think you need to take into consideration what the researcher, in this case, if we talk of surveys, calculated surveys, what the researcher is really interested in measuring. So
right.
We can't drop what we want, but we need to simplify it, but keeping what the purpose was.
Right.
Okay. So, as I point, I went the wrong way again. No, we went there. You move the connectors, and we actually went ahead of ourselves, okay. And then you do a qualitative revision. So you get the idea there, and that's a start. Convert compound and complex sentences into simple sentences. The qualitative aspect is very subjective. at some point. How you word it may be different than how I word it, but are we getting the message through? It's more important, I think, than worrying about the use of very long, very difficult to understand words. Alrighty. Oh, just one thing. Free modifiers, we use like moreover, however, although, furthermore. Many times we don't need to use it. There are a lot of unnecessary words in our writing for our patients. We just don't need them. And in this example, it is not important, however, to understand everyone's point of view. I just remove that free modifier, and the sentence goes down to it's not important to understand everyone's point of view. It's just a drop in difficulty of reading. Do we need, however? The stylistic.
No, it's because there's a sentence before it that you needed, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully.
You know, diminishing cognitive access costs is really what we're trying to do, because it's not only making the documents simpler, but remember, do not forget the person interfacing with that information, whether by text or by monitor. You've got to remember that the qualitative aspect really refers to the person. And so we go back to Johnny. Johnny went home and did as he was told, but first he stopped at the market or grocery store in this case. That read at 5. Now you may say, well, let's leave it at 5th. That's grade level. Why are you messing with that sentence? Because, as I pointed out, we have a large community of people in this country who read very, very poorly. And even if you had high school educational attainment, now 30, 40 years later, as you're aging, and as chronic diseases burden us, our literacy skills decrease. And you've got episodes, for example, I have a daughter who frequently receives type 1 diabetes and has frequent hospitalizations. When she's hospitalized, she doesn't want to read anything. And that's one of the reasons that got into the animation. So we break it down into three simple sentences. If he's at first grade level, Jose, why are you going to first grade? I mean, he's at fifth grade. That's good. Everybody thinks that's good. This is even better, I believe. One thought at a time. This is targeting very poor readers. And believe me, if in the hospitals, we know. We see it. Okay, and in research, we see it. So you can even simplify it even more from a visual display point of view by bullying. So now Johnny, did he get what he was told? He went home. Oh, and stopped at the grocery store. It's the same information, but one is easier to read in chunks as opposed to the first line, and this one is much visually compelling. And that's what McLaughlin was talking about, who created the smile, right?
I wouldn't put that question Kate asked me, because I think that is bogus, just because it's bogus.
I'm sorry?
It'll give you that, you're putting zero there, right? What is that question Kate saying?
The flesh, oh, that's a one, actually. Actually, it came out to 0.5.
It was different than the one above?
Are you talking about this?
Yeah, compared to the one above. It shouldn't be any different. I know it comes up that way when you do it, but it's not, that's not a right estimate.
One first grade. That's
another time. I agree. I don't think the program can't detect the simplicity of
it. Yeah, this didn't change. Yeah. This didn't change. Well, thank you for that, actually. I'm glad I did the typo. Because, you see, this, the readability, the grade level estimate, the difficulty estimate did not change. What changed was not the cognitive display design issue, the visual display issue changed. And it's very important when we communicate on paper that we make things compelling, as McLaughlin said. Which one would you rather read? I did that with the CAPS when we revised it to the CAPS-C and showed my mother, she's 86. Oh, that one's. So my 8-year-old grandson, they all picked CAPS-C. Yeah. I said, sorry, you better answer this. Let me give another consent form example. This is a real consent form that was submitted many years ago to Drew, and I was like, wow. Okay, 17th grade level, very difficult to read. This is from Bayard. We find all these connected words, we find coordinated conjunctives for the most part in this one. We find words like furthermore that we really don't need. So it's not only the connected words, look for terms in parentheses, look for those terms like furthermore, in addition, however, however, whatever, remove them, remove them and splice it there. And in this case, I just listed it, just to show you. And you can see that some of these fragments, these are dependent clauses, don't make any sense if they're not fixed. That now was where the quantitative aspect was just making smaller sentences, less words, less syllables. Now it's up to you to take this and make it digestible to the population talking. And I basically really simplified it. Let me see. I did not include everything. There was a lot of wording in there that I believed, and I appreciate the comments. From my perspective, I don't believe these words are necessary to communicate a thought, and so I remove them. You may not. You may not. And this is, so you go from, the researchers believe that the information collected will contribute to documenting the first aid preparedness of inner city school employees and to identify their learning needs and attitudes towards acquiring and providing first aid skills. Furthermore, I like that, huh? This information will serve as a basis for developing a curriculum for providing first aid skills to school employees. And this is consensual. Right. So we kick it with Fombe's boots, and we get the information he gives me helps us to learn how ready school employees are to get first aid. What school employees need to learn about first aid. How school employees feel about giving first aid. How best to teach school employees about first aid. Which one would you want to give your research participant? A or B? A? B people? Nobody? No B people either, huh?
B people.
Oh, no B people. On my A list now. Okay, so we go before being kicked by Fombe's boot, so after being kicked. Readability previously was 17, now it's 4. But again, it took you, as if you were molding a pot, to hold it where you want it. For whatever purpose you want it to be. Some pots in ancient times are very uses that were not honorable, and some were very honorable. But it just depends on what you need it for, if you get my drift. So, here's this was something that when I was submitting an IRB application, and I was told that I had to include this, right? And I said, what? Are they serious? When you do the readability assessment, though, you have to remove numbers. So I removed the numbers. It's still 16 grade level. And this project was targeting aging Latinos. So what did I do? I kicked it with Fombe's boot. And I sent it back to IRB. And I said, I cannot use that because the premise of the study is to develop easy-to-read forms and information. And it will violate the premise of the study. And not only that, it violates ORC dictates to give clear and understandable communication and informed consent. Well, that's who said that to me. And I refused. I redid it, I kicked it with Fombe's boots, I sent it back in the application, and I said, the UCLA ORP has permission to use this rendition whenever they want. And could you imagine? That's informed consent. Well, that's basically it. I wanted to show you some other stuff, but I think that's enough. I'd really like to just spend the next 10 minutes just going back and forth on this. I really enjoyed the time as well.
Could you say a little more about how this application is, for what purpose, versus...
Like this application?
Everything you're talking about, versus, like, if you want to read a good book, right, then you're not saying that this is the book that everybody's going to enjoy when it's very simple. So what are the sort of the parameters around the application that you're thinking of? When is this good? I know you're saying for survey research when you're targeting, you know, people that have lower education.
When is the simplification good?
Yeah, this whole technique.
That's actually an interesting question. I would say that in the beginning, we spoke about the fact that it's about targeting specific populations. There are populations that you don't have to worry about this with at all. Well, come on, if they give me a consent form like that, or you guys here, you ladies here, it won't be an issue. We can read it, we understand it.
Yeah, but wait, I want to stop, because there, I would think a lot of times the simplification is good for everybody. It's mm-hmm. like, it depends on how you go, but a lot of times people are
go too far. You think that's pretty much what you're, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, yeah, if it was like, you know, see the spot run, people might say, you know, this is childish. And
that's a really interesting point, Ron. We went through that with the animation. And when we were testing the animation on diabetes, and before we published that paper, so we did a randomized controlled trial to see if animation actually does improve health literacy, as measured by the Diabetes Health Literacy Survey. Some of the feedback I received along the way was especially for printed material that's easy to read, that it may insult some people. When I give it to Martin, he's really mad. Give me the real, I want the real, why, Joe, why are you giving me this? This must be your grandson's. You know, and the truth is, there are people who would find it offensive, believe it or not. But I would rather offend 1% of the population and inform 99% of the population. Yes, ma'am.
So I was watching Bill O'Reilly on TV
the other night. The wrong factor.
And he gives his little sermon at some point. I haven't seen it very often. But when he's giving his little thing, his editorial, I mean, the whole show is editorial. He has this one thing where he does this thing where he gives this blurb and he puts, he obviously has planned it, and he puts text up, fairly simple text up, as he says it. And I think, presumably, to try to reinforce the points that he's making or try to get across the message. Listening to you talk about this, sorry, I was late, made me think about whether he is using the same kind of strategy, that he wants people at a base. It would be interesting to do an analysis of the level at which his text goes. And whether having the text in front of the individual plus a verbal component, in fact, reinforces things more. I think one of the problems with giving people anything to read is if they never read, even if it's at a grade 4 level,
that's interesting. Because a lot of people who watch the O'Reilly Factor are not intellectuals. And I know many people that watch it who are pretty much the average reader. And that's why he's so successful, because he's actually reaching out and drawing in not only the pundits and the intellectuals, but people who are average people. Yes. And a lot of people I know that like love the O'Reilly Factor. But
well, it's very different from, say, William Butler, who was aiming at kind of a similar
at that 1%,
right?
But with animation, you think animation falls into that, Peter? Into any kind of, would you be insulted if I showed you an animated video on diabetes, for example, which we have and we've tested, and one on breast cancer, which we tested, and people really responded to it. Not only in knowledge skills, knowledge, but in self-management. Women going from mammography and South Central, doing self-breast exams. With the diabetes video, which has just for comprehension. So would that be... Everybody has grown up with cartoons. So would that not be as offensive we cross culturally, we cross nationally. So it's very interesting, the whole concept of health communication. We just need to find other ways of doing it. And now with all the electronic devices, there's apps for everything. And then we're using it. CAPS has an app for phones. And we're looking to use tablets in the near future to surveys and to teach using animation. That's right there, the same tablet.
Yeah. I think part of the problem is, your examples are wonderful. I would never disagree with wanting to simple questions and get more people answered accurately. But especially when you're giving information, the simplicity will often require that you don't give details. And you don't talk about exclusions. And you don't talk about the example that doesn't fit. And I think that that information given to the wrong population, so the more sophisticated population, results in them discounting the information that's being transmitted because they know that you're dumbing it down.
And one of the things that I realized at that point, also, and we talked about this, Rhonda, with the CAPS, just we developed this easy to read and hopefully comprehend, that's what we're going to be touching soon, with Altamed, by the way. And we just got the okay right away, right? It was about 10 minutes ago, or an hour ago. And the original version, there's no reason necessarily to get rid of it because there's an easy to read version. You need to know, again, if these items mean the same thing. That's one of the cognitive engineering strategies. But what we're not saying, you know, we're going to supplant what you've been working 20 years to do. We're saying we know that there's a large population in this country that uses it, responds to it, understands it, but we also have a growing population that doesn't. And their opinions about this is experiential performance measurement, the comparative ratings, and their opinions are not being included. And in fact, Margaret Thatcher pointed that out, that NASA surveys at the time in the 80s were not including minorities. And so there was no basis for comparison.
Heckler.
Pardon?
Margaret Heckler.
Heckler, I'm sorry. What did you say? Thatcher. I said, yeah, the Prime Minister of England was very concerned with black minority health in the United States. Margaret.
I think it would be really interesting to do a study comparing a text, informed consent, to a text where there's an audio that you can listen to while you're reading it.
Whoa.
I think for some populations that would be really helpful. And I think they're confident they might be a lot higher. Well, that would be not that difficult to study.
Dr. Shapiro is touching on an area that I'm exploring right now in terms of oracy. And it is the counterpart of literacy. That is that oracy, by definition, just means the skills you have in using words and conveying ideas by word. And you can actually study this in school. But oracy is also the whole idea that I have a consent form, you can't read, I'm going to read it to you. However, the use of the language is not the language you use day to day. So oracy is an important concept. Then that's why simplifying documents that are easy, you know, in small chunks, in simple words, if I'm doing a phone survey, this is one of the things that we posit. We're doing mail outs with first, with the CAPS and the regular CAPS, but in the future, I think one study would be, how does it affect phone surveys? How do people respond more often to the easier questioning? And so that's a very interesting point. So oracy is an issue I didn't get into today because I didn't want to get a diver or just go off tangents here. But that's also important. If you're reading a difficult-to-read document to someone who has limited literacy, it still may not be comprehensible to them. Especially if you say things like a structural grammatical unit. Okay. Thank you so much. I hope you got something out of it. Now, next Monday, we move from simple sentences to poetry. We move from grammar to poetry. And I think you'll find that very interesting. That's controversial. was stanzaic versification or versification from prose poetry is a practice. And there's, and poetry is a wonderful thing. You can go from the straight up verse to, you know, to prose poetry, which Hemingway clearly was one of the masters of, and then from there to stanza, to verse itself. So you go from prose to prose poetry to stanza. And essentially, I took a passage of Hemingway and I verbatim. And it's still, it's easier to read. Oh my God, he writes a long, one sentence is a paragraph. And it was easier to read, and I didn't change the wording. But when you go to stanza, it's just another dimension. It's just another dimension. It's easy to read, it's easy to look at. And it just, the way, it, again, it depends on the person. And you asked a question one time when, in the previous presentation, where do you end the stanza and go into the next line?
Right.
And that's very important. For example, subject, object, verb, that may be it. You shouldn't have, for a question, one sentence for a question, like a survey question, shouldn't be more than two, max three lines. And those three would then pretty much correlate with subject, object, verb. And just give you just a little bit. And there's a lot to it. I went deeper into it after we had that presentation. And back to my poetry. I minored in English in undergrad, and a lot of it was poetry. And so it hit home with me. This is a great way of communicating to people. If I can entertain you, I can educate you. That's called entertaining. Okay. Thank you very much, and I'll see you one day.